Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. How are you? It's good to have you sit in and join us, and it's a pleasure. I've been marveling at the changes in attitudes about masonry that's happening around me from within the craft. It's as if, and this is really quite wonderful. It is as if. There's been a discovery of a whole, maybe it's the expression of the personal connections that brethren have felt about masonry that have been, I don't know whether they've been taken granted or just undervalued, not valued, or perhaps there's been an awkwardness or consciousness about it. I cannot think for a minute that given the aim of masonry, you know, self-awareness, and the richness of the material that we're exposed to, that we could expect that change. You know, the premise that somehow, the premise here, I think, needs to be a little clearer. We're really pursuing the idea of virtue. To live a virtuous life is to live a better life. Now, better and best, that is in the eye of the beholder, but there's been a great many truly significant thinkers over the course of history who have suggested or articulated this very point. And it makes us, generations on, a moment to pause, to reflect, to consider the merit of the idea for themselves. I don't know if I will, if I'm comfortable suggesting that we are completely a product of our environment. You know, the nurture nature. sense of how we absorb, and I think now there's perhaps a lot to be said about our early childhood, what's happened around us, the people, our caregivers, the structure of the world that we came into when we were enormously impressionable. And that's not to say that we're limited. And am I suggesting here that a person cannot change? No, not for a moment. People change all the time, but most often it's private. It's not a fanfare. They're not going to have a parade or a certificate handed to them by the mayor. do they make those changes in much more discreetly, which is a word that you know, embodies much of masonry. It is, I hope that we can feel good about the subtlety of the craft. It's almost an expectation, isn't it? When you at least look at it, if we want to be consistent with the history, subtlety, nuance, and the ability to do things, the ability, the history of doing things that have some foresight. Like, we can see in the idea itself or the action that some thought went into it, and that the purpose itself, when we get around to the purpose itself, often it was for the betterment of other people on a pretty big scale. Now, we also, what we didn't see and what we don't have recorded are the smaller victories, the smaller efforts, the more discreet. And I'm particularly speaking to men who have taken this idea of defining charity by both hands. There is a point, and the one that's continuously, is there 7 levels of charity, I think, you know, for those who, for that it matters. It has always struck me that the progress has been to a greater and greater discretion until the person, the recipient, isn't aware of the direction that the assistance is coming from. So my question was immediately, how does it feel like beneficial if I come up to you and do something for you without talking, speaking to you about it? You can be puzzled, like, you know, obviously I'm thinking about myself, my own situation, not necessarily yours. And that, I think, it may be fair in some instances, but I think too that we aren't taught to crash into these kinds of decisions, this kind of thinking. We're taught to, I think, to be observant, so that when you know what the person needs, and it's what that person is thinking, not what I'm thinking or you're thinking about them. What does the young mother with struggling to keep ends together, make ends meet and put food and shelter for her child while she works at a couple of low-paying jobs to pay for her tuition to get by, or the woman that, frankly, is overwhelmed by the whole matter. And for somebody, an old boy like me, to think smugly, I might add, that woman is unworthy, that she turns to government assistance. How dare her? How dare she turn to government help? And then some men think, where is the father? Where is the family? And the unpleasant reality is those institutions aren't what they ought to be. have been assuming wrongly that everybody is upstanding. And it isn't the case. You and I know that. So what to do about the tragic situations that nobody deserves, that it is a matter of circumstance? Well, it's hard to admit that circumstance has such a tight hold on us and can be so influential. And what does it do? Leave you and me to feel, to be judgmental? Here we go again, another one just on the dole, with the hand out. You've heard that. How meager. The we shift that slightly and talk about rights. And then we shift that again and dive into the science of that kind of a situation and what that lifestyle does to the developing child. And that ought to concern a lot of us, I think. Good men. It isn't pretty, and I'm not going to recite the effects, but it is life-changing. That underwhelming diet and what that does to learning, does it matter? Well, a proposition was put to me a while ago that has puzzled me. If I'm a person who believes if we live in the culture that we live in, will instill certain benefits to all of us, and that and it requires of us that when this society around us is correcting, controlling, penalizing, I ought to accept that as well. That's the cost of living in all these benefits, living in that kind of state of to hear the safety and the predictability and the system. It has a lot of benefits. I'm not going to talk now about oligarchs and what's happening with the shift in wealth. That's not something that I want to get into here on this program. What does that do? What that tells us is that it raises the question, and the proposition is, if somebody is living large and has worked the system to their benefit, and you and I haven't had that conversation, have we, about what is enough? The CEO that just got a couple of million dollar raise because he reduced the financial loss of the company, government-funded company. I won't talk about whether that's legitimate or not. But does that person, does that group of people, that upper, 2% or the oligarchs, the upper 5%, have a responsibility to assist with the circumstantial tragedies? How different is their circumstance in terms of our value structure and ethics from the situation of the people that we refer to as victims? And they don't, the victims don't do that. People for whom the system is not as forthright, let me put it that way, and you know what I mean. Do they have an obligation? And how do we know that? How do we arrive at whether they do or not? Is it just a whim? Is it a notion that I have that they ought to be more obliging and more willing to assist? It sounds like I'm talking about more of a Scandinavian kind of a situation. Or am I talking about more of a Masonic kind of an environment? I think I am. I think I'm talking about the kind of environment that Masonry outlines for us, and rightfully so. It's not a struggle for good men to embrace these values of, supporting one another, to show some restraint. And to carry ourselves with dignity. That's, I don't think, a hardship or an imposition on decent men, good men. There is a but here. But what do we do in the meantime? We can do things. We have governance structure, but it's not as burdened with the responsibilities as our nation. Our systems are very, very complex, and they're under, we know they've always been targeted by people who want to manipulate these systems for whatever reason. Now we're more and more aware of that. In the age of communication, it's harder and harder to bury these, to hide these indiscretions. And where do we go from there? Well, that's what brings up the show, the whole point of the show today. For some, it's connecting. Do I have a connection and a responsibility? It's hard, isn't it? It's hard. If I look at the whole body of, you know, the social structure and the unfairness, what can I do? Well, what I can do is think more like a worker bee. What can the worker bee do? Well, one worker bee doesn't do very much, but an entire colony thrives and exists and has order to it. And you know, in our earlier days, the notion of those beautifully woven hives, you've seen them, was more prevalent in our lodges. The idea is about the integration, the specificity of all these different roles fitting together. I know. Where I am, we have a lodge that feels empowered, and I guess that's a word to use. They want to use a command structure. You're ordered to do things. You're ordered to attend. It's command. Tell me the command structure in a beehive. I think, if you will allow, that our command structure, if you want to call it that, is instinctive. I don't think we can take the sow's ear and turn it into a silk purse. We either you can and feel comfortable as a participant and instinctively, perhaps it's because for whatever reason you like the outcome, or you like the participation, or your role in contributing. Does that feel like it's personal? I can't imagine anything being more personal. Those are the kind of conversations I have with my very closest to Masonic brethren, where then we become very emboldened and start to have those conversations out loud. And oh my goodness, the reaction is beautiful. The reaction to when you see people listening to these conversations, they've had them too, or they've had the thoughts. Or they've been searching for it and wondering, where is this part of masonry? Where is the magic? Where is the mystery? Where is the dialogue? Jim, always the dialogue. So today, full disclosure, I'm working, because right now the idea of lodge is more complex than it is complex. I'm trying to break it down into some steps. And part of the step is to refer to a portion of our work as a troupe. In every bit, this sense of theater, where there's a sense of, and you think about yourself, if you had that experience, you've been around a theater troupe, the enthusiasm, the joy, the effort, nothing held back to create that moment behind the fourth curtain, where the intensity and the emotion connects with the audience. Sublime. And the effort that it takes to get there isn't an issue. It's validation. It's the value added to the whole effort. It becomes important, meaningful, if you will. I'm not a big fan of people going through the motions. And certainly, I'm not saying that everybody that ever stepped on the stage at Stratford had a deep sense of the meaning of their lines. But I am saying that vast majority of the people that made the magic happen on the stage certainly understood the why and the what of what they were doing, connection. It was their connection, that impact, that inspires audiences. The same, similar with masonry. When you see a man who is comfortable in his own skin, that is so confident he need not brag about his abilities, it's inspiring. And to see his personal connection with the work being shared with you and I. Now, I'd like you to, I hope you'll sit back and enjoy the program today. Thank you. I'm tuning in listeners of the Sudan. I want to talk to listeners from the South Sudan about the history. Oh, magnificent history in this country. Beautiful, beautiful people. And listeners tuning in from Pakistan and China. And I'm particularly pleased to share with you that we have had people tuning in from Russia and as far away as Russia and the United States and Ireland and Britain and Latvia that and Brazil, not to forget, and New Zealand. It's compelling. Enjoy what we have offered to you. The poetry is fantastic. William Wordsworth, a sonnet. You know, let's not gush over too much. And here, this is Miles Davis. I don't know if there's ever a time when I can't remember a time when I didn't appreciate after discovering something unusual. Maybe that's what the appeal was, something unusual, I like to think. Can I talk? May I share a commentary with you? For some, it's connecting. I might be prompted to think questions from a curious person about something esoteric or artful was a reflection of something known already. Familiar in a way. Whatever our start point, there's room for an exchange. Whether privileged or perceived privilege, there is no one able to escape conscience. or questioning whether their life represents anything of merit to the world. I think we know money doesn't buy happiness. Celebrity is isolating. Privilege for those with it is still a distortion. A distortion of a reality. We can recall the early days of the Buddha. His father protected him from the unpleasantness of real life. And we can recall the education as he left that sheltered environment and went out into the real world and what he saw. The hunger and degradation at a level unknown to him. And that was necessary in some way. It tired him, and he sat under that tree, and we know the story, the legend of enlightenment. But if one is struggling to get by and provide, or faces hunger and sleeping rough, the question is about survival. It is not difficult for men with a moral core to understand. I'll temporarily associate myself with that group, shall I? We're born with it. An emptiness. Most of us learn from mistakes. Some learn to lie to survive, not knowing the price they'll pay. Do we look to rank and fortune or power to find character? At some point, we realize we cannot go on blaming our struggles or on circumstance over which we have no control. It is our lot in life to make whatever we can with what we have. The assumption of responsibility is where judgment matures. When we start to make that assumption, nobody's going to fix this. Being negative about it only makes us unhappy. It's a burden. You can say, my goodness, it's absolutely the truth, but there are other ways of looking, other perspectives. We can't go on, but you can. And what happens? Bitterness. It is our lot in life to make whatever we can with what we have. Education has been a vehicle for change for people who have lived without. Why does the young mother work two jobs, attends classes, and raises her son the best she can? It's sacrifice, isn't it? This will stop with me. This hunger, this degradation will stop with me. I need not dwell on the darkness of the roots or the background. The next generation is important. Why do entire families pool their resources to put the children into the best schools? Why does a mother and father want a better life for their child? Education is about freedom. Education is about living longer with fewer diseases and illnesses. If you're looking for a why, for women and minorities, it's about fighting for equality. And on that spectrum, for hundreds of years, Masonry has been introducing men to higher level thinking. Not any man, but a man who values learning. I once heard a person describe the value of education in this way. Someone can try and take me away from my roots, take me away from my family and deprive me, but they can never take away my learning. They can never take away the joy of my and the benefit of my education. that's something that we control within the control. It's with you forever. And as a legacy, you pass that on. Whether it's the striving, the work, the sacrifice to get there, you pass that on too. So that the accomplishments have value. And we teach that to our sons and daughters. The importance of working for what they have so that you feel you have skin in that fight, a dog in that fight, as they say, that it matters. Have you talked to your relatives about a time when they were deprived? You see, they often don't want to be reminded of that. Or they'll tell you that they worked very, very hard so that that never happened again. They always, you know, you went to Granny's and she had extra, she had a pantry with canned goods just in case, because you never know. That's the voice of somebody that's lived through some very painful episodes. And it, around me, it might not happen because of armed conflict, might happen because of environmental change. I'm living in an area where the environment doesn't really come in and the climate doesn't really come and ask permission. The fates, I call it the fates. But the importance, how to resolve it, we can be bleak about it, or we can share the skills that helps us to identify the threat, and to that done, we can take steps to protect ourselves. The threat is the threat, but let's pass on all of that learning to people that matter to us. Here, I found this this song called Lover Man. It's by Sonny Stitt. It's an old tune. Tell me if it works. Yeah, that's lovely, isn't it? Now, I want to experiment with you a little bit. Yeah, great deal. I want you to tell me if this makes sense to you and if it applies in your own life. I'm going to start with a declaration. This is where we're getting in poetry, and you know I'm a. I just have latched onto sonnets. I just find I look at it like the for me it's one of those beautiful structures, and I love the challenge of it. Let me put this out there that anybody, you and me, has a poem inside him, and it could be crummy, it could be excellent. But with enough practice, we can see it, that something being described. And we have these wonderful poets, the Elizabethan and Renaissance and poets of the Enlightenment, that perhaps go a little deeper into the human psyche, the Byrons and the Coleridges and the Burns. I'm going to start with a premise here, and I want you to, this is the experiment, and I want you to share with me if there's a proof. Reading and writing poetry actually gives people the improved ability to understand others. Is this so? Reading poetry can actually help our mental health, so it has been said. Poetry helps improve ideas. Now tell me, is this so? Have you ever sat there and not known what to write, and picking up poetry, reading through different excerpts from classic poets can foster ideas that you never knew existed. And reading and writing poetry makes you think of new ideas, but can also dramatically change the way you and I perceived old ideas. It is a way to process experiences, visual descriptions, and emotions. In the words, and you think about that field of daffodils dancing. Can you picture, you close your eyes, daffodils? Well, for those of you who haven't seen it, yellow things, primarily yellow things growing, pretty. These words give us some visuals, and we can have it. We can, if we're fortunate, if you've sat in front of in a gallery looking at some of Van Gogh's work, and I sat there and tried to connect with the emotion. What was he sharing with me emotionally? And all of a sudden, my goodness, you can say, silly old man. Yes, I am often accused of that, sometimes many times before I've had breakfast in the morning. There was a connection, and it's there for those who can feel that transmission. Does everybody? Well, I saw the idle people just going by and giving it a quick glance because you've got your mind somewhere else. You're focusing on getting to the restaurant in time to meet everybody for lunch. I don't. They may just like the sound or the feel or the climate of a gallery. They may just need their sit in there to collect your thoughts. The National Gallery in Scotland does that for me. It's just so atmospheric. And that, brethren, is what I try to instill in the lodge. A place where a man can find himself, collect his thoughts, be inspired. There's no one, it's not to be defined, because as soon as I would define the value of that, I'm limiting it, aren't I? Mm-hmm. Poetry is therapeutic. Mm. Writers get in touch with sentiments that might not have they known until it was put down on paper. It's a good outlet. And it is for the writer as well as the reader, especially for people who have a hard time expressing themselves. My dear grandfather, Cyril Snowden Toombs, bless his soul, fits this category. It's there for a man, a very stoic fellow, but he had a well-thumbed copy of Robert Burns' poetry. That now sits on my shelf, I'm happy to say. He had a hard time expressing himself, but through the poetry, he was able to connect. It allows one to see into the soul of another person. That knowing that he had that work told me so much more about him. It can open feelings. It helps us understand the significance of words. It helps us to understand people. One of the hardships of the current age is the ability to understand one another. Miscommunication and misunderstandings may lead to massive amounts of frustration. Reading and writing poetry actually gives people the improved ability to understand others. And that being the case, it should be a poem, should be part of the front page. I notice some of the better publications like Prospect Magazine or The Guardian, if you're prone, make frequent reference to poems, poetry. from a writer's perspective, you have to be able to convey the true nature of your writing to an unknown reader. That means diving deep into what parts you want them to understand, what you want them to feel, what you want them to take home with them that will resonate long after they've read it. So you're conveying personal opinion and the ability to empathize. That is respectable communication. And ever felt out of place? Have you ever wondered why you're thinking or feeling a certain way? Ever been frustrated because your friends or your partners couldn't possibly understand, because you don't even understand what's going on in your own head? One of the best ways to grasp internal turmoil is to write poetry. It slows the world down. You find the world is happening. You have those moments where it's just all a blur. Poetry. It streamlines thoughts into short, direct sentences. And there's a soothing the anxiety. But in a lyrical style. No, I don't do things out of fear or under threat of condemnation or penalty. I do things because I'm inspired. And I need, in my own life, I need an assist. I need that sensibility that helps me to reconcile and to improve and to understand and to encourage. There's no greater sadness than not knowing one's self-worth. But there's no greater power than complete understanding of one's identity. Now, is this true? Poetry can give you that power. William Wordsworth, eh? Do we need to get into the history of the man? Not a problem. We can certainly do that. It's, you know, when do you not want to know? But I'll leave that with you. It was, he chummed with some interesting, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, you know. Yeah, that guy. Mm-hmm. Interesting man. This is a guy, you know, 1770 to 1850. He's in that period. The expansion. Mm-hmm. We know him for lyrical ballads. The romantic epic poem. Here. The sonnet. Tell me if this works for you. I think I'm going to there. You hear me clicking away here? Just I'll give you just a few little hints here. Just a few, not to go overboard. And then you can see it's like telling you, I'm going to explain to you the ideas, some of the ideas and analysis, and then you can compare your own thoughts as you will. Yeah? The poem takes shape as a speaker describing the sights and feeling of a quiet early morning before the city springs to life. Does it do that for you? As he begins this, the high praise, Westminster Bridge, there is nothing fairer in all the world, and anyone who could see. He describes a view of London from a spot on the bridge early, and you can see spires and domes. Tell me if it does that for you, if you feel that, if you feel the, you know, leaving the world of nature, and you know he's reflecting on the view that inspires his understanding of the potential for beauty in ordinary things. Wouldn't that be a gift, to find beauty in ordinary things? Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent. Ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open onto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep on his first splendor, valley, rock, or hill. Never saw I, never felt so calm and so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep. And all that mighty heart is lying still. Oh, Albert Nichols and Herb Hall. Oh, this is a very, very long time ago. New Orleans Trio. Lovely. Lovely. Do you mind if I dip into a part of history that talks about, history of us, that talks about a reaction to imperceptions? Perceptions of the craft. Of course, by 1791, the hostile critics of Freemasonry, who had invented the myth of its conspiratorial role in the revolution, repeatedly attacked the fraternity for the subversive implications of its organizational structure, entwined with politics was religion. Freemasonry was subversive because of its associations with England, with Cromwell, with the deists and atheists of the Enlightenment. From as early as 1730s, not only were the political values disseminated by the Republic of Letters distrusted for their English and Dutch associations, the greatest fear they aroused centered on the subversion of traditional religiosity. These fears could only have been exacerbated by knowledge of the ritualistic and ceremonial side of Freemasonry, to which police spies as early as the 1740s alluded. The opponents of Freemasonry were frequently the enemies of the Enlightenment. Let that sink in. As one Masonic orator shrewdly put it, and quote, "The churchman only imagines that we profess an all-new religion. Yes, he says, the thing is only too certain. The children of light shun the light." Our orator never denied the religious analogy, nor did he seem bothered by the condemnations he got from the clergy. He simply affirmed the secrecy within which Freemasonry hid their enlightenment. At other lodges, orators spoke about the first apostles of the Masonic religion who have invented these mysterious emblems intended to protect the truth, to hide from the contempt of the profane, from the persecution of the fanatic. In the 1760s, Dutch brothers discussed a change in the ancient rituals in these terms. It seems to us that some differences from one lodge to another should not be more interesting than the differences in customs of people who profess the same religion. French Freemasons of the late 1770s praised the newly reconstituted Grand Orient as the keeper of the true Masonic religion. A decade earlier, Strasbourg Freemasons described a priest who wanted to join their lodge as enlightened. But after he sought instruction in our mysteries without seeking membership, he was regarded with great suspicion. Yet many Catholic clergy did belong to lodges. Almost never is the Masonic religion identified with Christianity. But then, never is it described in language that would render Freemasonry overtly hostile to the churches. Just as in Britain and Sweden, Protestant countries where Freemasons assembled publicly in churches, Parisian Freemasons assembled at least once a year at a solemn mass. Similarly, German Freemasons, as early as the 1740s, hotly denied that they were in any way atheists, rebels, or unmanly. Clearly, the charges of political subversion, irreligion, and sodomy were most commonly made against the society and generally made in the same breath. I see that the time to wrap up is on us. And I reluctantly sign off. I hope you will continue to commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And if it was possible by some magical process to exchange all of our value judgments with Masonic values, I would wish that for you from an old guy, an old boy. We have a purpose, more than we talk about, purpose of our collective. And we do have our critics and our skeptics. There are brethren who are hesitant. They simply haven't been taught. We know that the craft has faced these issues many times. This is not new. And you can imagine we've had how many hundreds of years to think about this and put it down. And what's shared with us isn't the totality, it's the best of the ideas. For every inspired book or chapter that we read, we can only imagine the hundreds or thousands of hours of debate or silliness that went on around the lodge, or indifference or ambitions, where people were not there for the spirituality, for the experience of an enlightenment, or had their own ambitions rather than that created barriers to them accepting some of these unusual notions of altruism and universality. How do we do that? I hope you'll come back next week and we'll talk about it again. And we'll try and answer those questions for ourselves. Thank you very much for sitting in. And I look forward to being with you again very, very soon.